Okay, we are on Daf Lamed Tes Amud Aleph. We are moving along. The bottom line of Lamed Tes Amud Aleph. Amar Rav, second word. Amar Rav, Chavis Asur B'chosam Echad, Champag Muter B'chosam Echad. This is, in my mind, somewhat unusual in the Gemara when you actually get the mnemonic and then the Gemara explaining it. It's pretty rare, actually. But the Gemara says, what is chavis? Chalav, chalav, basar, yayin, and tcheles. So it means if you send chalav Yisrael, you need a double seal. If you send basar, kosher meat, you need a double seal. If you send kosher wine, you need a double seal. And if you send tcheles, you need a double seal. So we've spoken about this a little bit last week, which is that tcheles is expensive. So these things, in order to assume that they are actually going to be considered kosher, so you need to have a double seal. Now, the question that arises, we spoke about this, but it's worth reviewing, is earlier in the perek, when they first discussed yayin, so there was a machlokas, but it appeared that the maifor will be the maskana, the gemara, was that wine only requires a single seal. So the question is, why would wine, which is certainly would seem to be one of the most biggest problems of all the substances, why would the wine require the bigger seal? Why would wine only require one seal there? And here, yet the Gemara listed amongst the things that it required two seals. So there were two major approaches in the Rishonim as to how to deal with this particular issue. One issue, I think, was Rabbeinu Tam, who said that Gemara that required only one seal was dealing with a non-Jew, and this is dealing with a non-from Jew. When you deal with a non-Jew, so one seal is sufficient. But you deal with a non-from Jew, so a Yisrael Chashud, we are more Choshed than a non-Jew. The second approach, which I think is the more appealing approach, is that contextually appealing, is that the sugya there was dealing with a case where a Jew was sending it, or he was entrusting the wine with a non-Jew, and he put his seal on it. So in the end, he's going to come back. He's going to be able to identify what his seal was. So if the Gentile did something, you assume that he would try to break in and then reseal it. The Jew knows what the original seal looked like. He's probably able to identify it. This Gemara, which says you require two seals, is a situation where you're never going to see it again. This is Shaleach. That was a case of Mafkid. This is Shaleach. You send it to somebody else, so you're never going to see it again, and the recipient has no idea what your two seals look like. So unless you have a way of communicating to him exactly what the seals look like, you require for certain foods two seals. Now the question, of course, the Gemara is going to discuss a little further what's going to take one of these things out and do a substitution. The question is, what exactly was the concern with these things? Why is it that chavis, let's see, we didn't finish reading, chalap aso yayin and treles are prohibited with one seal, asur mechosim echad, chiltis, now the champag, chavis is a much better mnemonic. It's actually a word. Champag sounds like an Indian, American Indian, or Native American word. So chiltis, morias, pas, and gavina. So chiltis was the asafetida that we spoke about last week, that davar charif. And morias is the fish brine, and pas akum, and gavina sakum. So the question is, what exactly, why the difference between these two, right? If you're afraid that the guy is going to forge a seal, so why are you not afraid of one case? So Rashi writes on the top of Lamed Tes Amud Beis, the first Rashi, Asurim b'chosam echad lishager biyat ovei kochavim. You cannot send it through a guy with one seal. The chevan the basar tcheles demayan yikarim. Since meat and that is very valuable, as well as tcheles is very expensive. So tarachu mezayich lachalifam. He will make every effort to forge the seal in order to be able to steal them. He'll substitute inferior meat. He'll substitute at Kele Elon, the fake Tcheles die, and he'll get away. He can then take that Tcheles and sell it to someone. And remember, Tcheles and Kele Elon are actually testable. The Gemara gives you a way to distinguish between the two, because the Tcheles is fast, but the Kele Elon is not. So you can sort of launder the Kele Elon out. So therefore, the guy will substitute the fake Tcheles for the Tcheles, because you never know, your recipient's never going to think to look. And then he has real Tcheles that he can sell to someone, even someone who's going to test it. So those are very valuable, he'll forge. And the wine, because wine is always, again, in Perek Sheni, Avodah Zarah, Goyim have a particular affinity for wine. Nothing else. Everything else, they're just normal people. But wine, there's a sort of infatuation. Any wine that can be libate for Avodah Zarah, they choose to do. So, and then the last one, V'chalav parach l'kama. And the Gemara is going to challenge because chalav doesn't fit the pattern. So Rashi says basically that these are very expensive materials. Again, yayin is not necessarily, although Tosus talks about this a little bit. However, it's valuable. It's very valuable to him, even if it's not for strictly financial reasons. So if you take a look at Tosus on the first Amud, the bottom Tosus. Amar Rav Chavis Bechosam Echor Aser. Peirush Rashi in the Fish of the Mayim Yikarim. But Varav Rabbeinu Ephraim Bar David Haya Omer Hatam Mishum the Isa Li Isura Be'ene Aval Champag Eno Ela Ta'aroves. So he says that the difference between these two substances is that one of them, and this is actually very interesting from a conceptual perspective, one of them, the actual stuff, is inherently problematic. You're not dealing with a concern of a mixture of something else, but you're actually dealing with the substance itself. So I'm not sure how that fits with Cheles, but you understand that the basar is fundamentally usar. And the question is it basar? It's not that there's something mixed in with the basar. The yayin, the concern of stam yayinim, is not that it's not a taroves yayin, it's not that wine got mixed into something, but rather it's actually the wine is problematic. Leave out for the moment the chalav, because the Gemara is, firstly, chalav, as we know, is a problem of a concern of mixture. But the Gemara is going to substitute chalav out. It's going to bump it off the list. So we don't have to explain chalav. And tcheles, again, I'm not sure. Tcheles, it's not iser, but I guess, you know, it is a taroves, but I guess the wool is defined as tcheles if it's properly dyed. So you're dealing with not a concern of something else mixed in, but the actual integrity of the substance itself. And then when you look at the second list, which is chiltis, the concern with chiltis is that he cut it with a knife which had tarfus on it. And the concern with murias is that they mix a little wine in. And the concern with pas, well, that's tricky. Gvina could be a concern of something mixed in, the rennet that they use to make it. Pas is a little trickier, although the Gemara may take, Shmuel is going to take pas out of the list for not clear the reasons why. Pas itself doesn't really fit the pattern, because the pas itself is not a concern of tarobis. If you're not allowed to eat your neighbor's bread, it's not because the concern that they put treif in it. The reason you're not allowed to eat their bread is because of chasnos, because of intermarriage. So the pas itself really is asur. Unless you say that it's only nisa the rabbanon in the first place, the pas, even though it's the isur, nonetheless, they only required one seal, maybe something like that. So that's the position of Rabbeinu Ephraim. And Tosos goes on to point out why Rashi's position actually is a better position. Okay. So anyway, so the Gemara says that some things require two seals, some things require one seal. The Gemara now raises the question about pas. So the Gemara, now the truth is the Rashi claims that the pas actually belongs later in the sukkah. We'll see in a moment Shmuel citation, but we'll read this line in the Gemara now. And the line, the intent of the Gemara is not entirely clear. The Gemara says, pas l'maynecho shlei. What are you concerned about with bread? I mishum ichlufe krira bachamime meida yidia. If you're concerned about the guy, let's say he's going to substitute cold bread for stale bread for fresh bread, literally cold for hot, so you'll know the difference between the two. He's not going to get away with it. And if you're afraid of the chite b'disari, he's going to swap wheat and barley bread again. Now he made the idea. If the two breads are the same, since there's no great reason for him to do so, if once there's a seal on it, he's not going to swap it out. Now, the truth is the Gemara is somewhat odd. It's odd, firstly, because the Gemara starts out by saying, L'may Necho Shlei. If you say L'may Necho Shlei, you're suggesting that there are no problems at all. Number one. Number two, when you get to the end, that since the two breads are basically equal in quality, he's not going to forge a seal. So the truth is, even if you don't have a seal, why would he do it? Right? The assumption is, with the exception of wine, maybe even not wine, but certainly the exception of wine, the guy doesn't do something to cause us to violate an iser. The guy does it because he has some financial or other kind of incentive in it. So the line doesn't read exactly right, and Rashi says this doesn't belong here. And he puts it later. So let's, in Shmuel's words. Now, one of the crucial issues, and there is a machlokas harishonim here, is the intent of this passage to claim that pas doesn't even require a seal? Is that what its purpose is? And in most rishonim say no. It's just to talk about why something, you know, is either isn't in the list, but why it has a din of one seal. There is a minority opinion that suggests that, no, that the Gemara is really saying that there is no concern of pas at all, which does bring to mind an issue that we've spoken about before, which is the Hashgacha organizations. I know they used to do it in Pathmark, Olav HaShalom, and I assume it's probably still the same thing in Teaneck or Bergenfield. So they have they sell Italian bread, and the bag is not sealed, and it's got the Hashgacha on it. So if it were an issue of, if there were a concern of pas balabais, it would be much more of an issue. But the assumption there is that since it's clearly pas paltar, there's no reason to assume that anybody actually bothers to swap anything. You don't require seals at all. So it could be, even some would say, that when it comes to pas balabais, you don't require a seal on the bread because there's just no incentive. Again, if he's going to substitute a different quality bread, you're going to spot it. And that's the only reason he would do it. And since he's not going to substitute the same quality because there's no benefit to him, therefore you don't have to be choshish at all. Okay, so now the Gemara continues the following. So the Gemara says, the Rav, according to Rav, Maishna Gvina, the sixth line, Maishna Gvina de Lotara, Umezayef, Chalav Nami Lotara Chamezayef. Why is it that you assume that one seal is enough for a guy when it comes to Gvina Sakum, when it comes to the cheese, but when it comes to milk, you're not concerned? And in some sense, the concern, possibly, with Chalav Akum, you know, might be that there's some non-kosher milk there. That could be one of the reasons given for cheese. It's only one of the reasons in the Gemara is that there's non-kosher milk mixed in. Obviously, there are many other reasons as well. So, Amar Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana responds, Ape cholev ayil chatichas dag she'en bo simen. You know what? Ches should not be chalev akum, it should not be milk. And chavis, the ches refers to chatichas dag, which doesn't have a simen in the way that it was cut. In other words, if they cut the fish in a way... In the Gemara in Chulin, in the seventh parak, in the sugya of Basar Shenis Ali Mitha'ayin, the halacha is that if you leave meat lying around, I'll say nondescript meat, where it was not under any kind of guard, and it's conceivable that another person, a non-Jew, let's say, came in and substituted treif meat for the kosher meat, so the Basar is asur to eat. It's Exera Midrabana, and it's called Basar Shenis Ali Mitha'ayin, a Basar which was literally concealed from the eye. But the Gemara there, if I'm not mistaken, talks about how Amoraim, when they would sometimes send their meat, you know, send a messenger or something, you know, they might have had non-Jewish messengers, they would cut the meat in a distinctive fashion so that when it got home, so that they would know, right? I think, by the way, the same thing is true. It's a shayla could be raised. If someone has non-Jewish household help and you leave open meat in the fridge, one can ask the question whether there's a concern of Basar Shenis Ali Mitha'ayin. I don't think people are generally so concerned, but in some cases I think it's certainly less of a concern. Like my example I give, you have a salami that's, you know, in its wrapping, but you opened it partially and you've cut off parts, right? Mm-hmm. So even though, theoretically, someone could take another piece of salami and stick in that wrapping, it's almost inconceivable someone is going to, in your open salami, right? Imagine take the wrap and you cut it in half. It's very hard to do. I understand. So that's the equivalent, I think, of having a simen in the Basar. I think it's having a simen in the Basar. The other things also may function. The sim in the bus, right? If you cook your meat in a certain way, you know, and it's sitting in a pan, it's probably also not, you know, there's a sim in there, so that's how you get around the question of basar shenis ali min ha'ayin. So the same thing with the Gemara says here, chatichas dag she'en bo simen, if someone cut up pieces of fish, and you can no longer tell, the scales aren't on there, So in that case, there is a requirement of two seals. So basically, we've substituted chatichas dag ches for chalav akum, for chalav. So now the Gemara says, if that's the case, haynu basar. Why do you have to tell us two things? In other words, the whole point is that meat products don't start out with a cheskes kashrus until you know where the meat came from, and if it's an animal as opposed to, let's say, a fish, you need to know that it was slaughtered properly. So why does Rav have to tell us two things? Chatichas dag and basar. Okay. So that's a larger question that Rishonim don't discuss here. Why is it that a dag requires hechsher? In other words, meat I understand. Meat I understand because meat has a cheskas not being... The Gemara says in Chulin, a very important principle, Behema b'chaya b'cheskas iserim omedes ad shivad alacha b'meh huchshara, that a behema, when it's alive, is assumed to be usher. You can't eat it because it's not shechted yet. Until you know that it was shechted properly. Nishchata, once you know it was shechted properly, harehi becheskas kashrus, ad sheivada lecha bamen nitrefa. Then you assume that the animal is not a trefa until you have evidence that was a trefa. So that's why, if they cut open the animal after the shechita, and it was a proper shechita, and now they found a hole in the b'nei me'ayim, a hole in the intestines, but they might have been concerned that a fox came along and had, you know, caught it or something like that. So if you have a real suffix, so there the chazaka is that the behemah is kshera. So I understand why, bottom line, a behemah, why meat, why basar is becheskas not being kosher, and why you require higher sales. The interesting question is, why about fish? In other words, unless one posits that a majority of fish... This fish doesn't require, except for one funny shita, which the Beis Yosef quotes, we don't accept, that you can't eat a fish that washes up dead. You have to do asifa. You have to gather the fish in. That's like the shchita for fish. Hatzon v'akar yishachet lahem u'matzal lahem. Im es kol degei hayam ye osef lahem u'matzal lahem. So you require asifa by duck. So we don't paskin that way. So if that's the case, a fish doesn't require any preparation. You just need to know that it came from a kosher fish. So what is in fact the majority of fish that are found in the sea, or not even fish that are found in the sea, but that people actually fish out of the sea? You know, I presume that when you're looking at a slice of fish, but I don't know, that you can tell it's not crab or shrimp or an oyster or something, that's not the flesh of that. You can tell that it's fish flesh. The question is, I don't know.
I think only pink fish is always kosher.
Well, no.
What else you don't know?
No, I agree. That's why salmon... That's why salmon does not require the scales on it. That's why, personally, we buy salmon from Costco.
Right.
Because you know that you're looking at fish. Although, the interesting thing that complicates it, although I don't think you have to really worry about it, is the fish that you typically buy, unless it's a wild fish, the coloration actually doesn't come naturally. It comes from they stick a pigment in the food that they feed it or something like that. But it's true. The truth is there is also steelhead trout that seems to have the same color, at least at Costco. But yes, no non-kosher fish certainly naturally has the pink flesh, so that would be a sign. But even if it's not, let's say it's not pink flesh, so what is a majority of fish that is typically fished out? Because one, I would have assumed at least Din Torah, and maybe that is Din Torah, it should have been acceptable. I'm not sure. I'm saying this because if I'm correct that there's a difference... If there's a difference, minat Torah, between meat and fish, then the Gemara's question doesn't make as much sense. In other words, asking Rav, why do you have to tell us trei gav ne basar? You already told us basar, why do you have to tell chatichas dag? I'll tell you why. Because basar, I understand, requires two seals because the chazaka is that it's aser minat Torah until you know that it's kosher. But the fish, at least minat, if I'm correct, and I'm just not sure, if the fish, in fact, the majority of fish that's fished out of the sea that people sell, you know, that looks something like this, right? Is in fact kosher fish, then it would seem in Torah you should be able to rely upon the fish without being at least midat Torah, and therefore that's why Rav should have to tell you that even chatichas dag requires two seals. Okay. Anyway, be as it may, it's clear what the halacha is that you require hashgach on fish. It's clear from the Gemara if you require two seals on sending the fish, obviously. There needs to be some type of testimony, some type of aid, proof that the fish is kosher. Okay. So we've substituted chatichas dag for chalav. The interesting question is, where does chalav then fall in this constellation, right? Because, you know, unless the ches of champag does double duty, chiltis and chalav, I'm not sure. Okay. Now, Shmuel Omer, Shmuel has a different mnemonic. Bis aser b'chosam echad, bis, if you want, he took out the ches out of chavis, and machag mutar b'chosam echad. So what are these? So he took the pay out, he took out the pas, he took out the pas. So the Gemara says, the bis is basar yayin and tcheles asur b'chosam echad, morius, chiltis, and gavina. So again, it's three of the four in each of these, amutar b'chosam echad. So the Gemara says, "L'shmuel chatichas dag shein bo siman, haynu basar, treiv navne basar lo amrinan." So Shmuel says that the reason why it doesn't list chatichas dag is because we don't need to tell two different kinds of flesh. Okay, Fine. And what about pas? So that's what that's the question. Rashi says, if you look at Rashi on the third line on the top, the last two words, pas lemaynechoshla. Rashi writes klal lo garsinan. Haha, ela b'milsei dishmur garsinan lei, v'haha garsinan lei. In other words, Rashi says that those lines in the Gemara actually belong later. And then the question, as we mentioned before, is what, in fact, is the Gemara's conclusion? Is pas excluded from Shmuel's list because you don't need to say anything about it because it's obvious? Or is pas excluded from Shmuel's list because pas does not require even chosam echad? But as I said before, most of the Rishonim assume that pas requires... even pas requires a single seal. Just as Shmuel would say that a chatichas dog she'ein bo simen, the fish, also requires two seals. There's just no need for Shmuel to list it in his mnemonic because trei gavnei basar lo amrinan. Okay, I guess Shmuel was being very economical with the letters. The Gemara says in Psachim that olam yishana adam l'talmida derech kitzara, that when you're pedagogically speaking, and I think this is true, generally speaking, in the world of communication, it's important not to go on at great length, right? If you're trying to get a message home, so short and sweet usually is the way it does it. If I understand, the late Rabbi Joseph Lichtenstein used to say, if you haven't hit oil after 8 minutes, stop boring. The other famous line is, a good sermon is like a woman's skirt, which is it should be long enough to cover the material, short enough to make it interesting. So anyway, bottom line is that if message has to be focused, but it seems like Shmuel has taken it to an extreme here, right? Which is, he's being economical even in the letters. He gets down to six letters as opposed to eight letters of Rav. Obviously, what actually, the way the Gemara frames this, I don't think it's about saving letters. There's always the difficulty in pedagogy and communication between economy and clarity and a balancing between the two. And Shmuel arguably does not want to perhaps include anything extraneous, because then we're going to start asking, why did you list chatichas dal kam en basar? So the answer for Rav is trei basar, trei gavnei basar is not a very appealing answer. Rav, the way I would say, maybe wanted to, even, I don't know why Gemara didn't give that answer, but if I'm right that fish is a different status than meat, Rav perhaps wanted to make clear you didn't make a mistake. And the same thing when it came to pas. Like, Rav included pas because he wanted to make clear to you that it required chosam echad. And Shmuel said, well, it's obvious it requires chosam echad, and it's obvious that it doesn't require more than one seal, more than chosam echad. So Shmuel felt that he didn't want to list it, because otherwise you start asking, why the necessity? Okay, fine. Yes, Adrian.
So, but even if a fish needs a seal, if you see someone cutting the fish up in front of you, and you saw what kind of fish it was,
yeah, then that's not a problem. No, the
only if you buy it, like.
Correct. It's one of the interesting things in Teaneck, at least. I know my wife says that she annoys the people. There's a kosher fish store, and then there's the non-hashgacha fish store, not owned by Jews. And she always asks them, can you cut me from a piece? Let me see the fin. So they get a little annoyed, but I understand why they're annoyed, because from their perspective, we know that the fish is kosher. They're not pulling the wool over our eyes. And it's a little annoyance to them, and they probably plenty of Orthodox Jews with the text who go in and buy it and don't bother to ask to see the scales on the fish. But technically speaking, in order to buy that fish, really one is halachically required to see it. But if you see them cut up in front of you, that's not an issue. And I don't think we're concerned about knives on multiple levels. The stuff is cold. They also wash the knives in between, not for kashrus reasons, for hygiene reasons. And that's even assuming that they're really actually even selling anything non-kosher in the store and so on. So yes, but if you see the fish, enough of the fish, and the Gemara Daf Mem and Aleph actually is going to talk about what do you have to see of the fish, how much is enough. But if you see enough of indication on fish that you know that the fish is kosher, then yes, they can cut up the fish for you. That's a non-issue. Okay. Now the Gemara continues with a brisa. Tanu Rabbanan, ein lochem yamach machag besuria. Apparently, the merchants in Syria, Rashi says, the merchants in Syria were chashudim because they, this is unfortunately too common. Rashi says they weren't concerned about selling not, they may have been Jewish, they weren't concerned about selling non-kosher with other Jews. They wouldn't eat it themselves, but lifnei iver, they didn't care so much about it. It was somebody else's problem, not theirs. Okay, so these are the things that they were chashud to sell. Lo yayin, Okay, lo mor yas v'lo chalas. Even though it's a Jew and he says it's kosher wine, you don't necessarily believe him. And mor yas is the fish brine that might have had wine mixed in, and chalav was concerned of whether it's chalav chalev kasher or chalev tamea. V'lo melach sal kundaris. And you also can buy melach sal kundaris, which the Gemara will talk about. This a kind of salt, and the concern is going to be over some type of a mixture. It's pure salt is. There's only one way that I can figure out that salt could actually be usser if it's pure salt, and that is if somebody made it. If somebody used it in the worship of Avodah Zarah. Outside of that, salt is neither animal products, so it doesn't require any hechsher. It's neither an agricultural product that it could be usher because of trumas not having been tithed, because of orla, because of kilayim. So salt's a pretty safe substance if you know it's pure salt.
Yeah, and yet all salt has hashgachas.
So you know why that is? I'm not because most salt has iodine added to it. That's the reason why salt without iodine doesn't require hashgacha.
Right, so I'm talking about fancy salts.
Okay.
That come from all over the world. You know, they have all these salts that you can buy, and they all have hashgacha.
So I would imagine if these are pure salt, they don't require hashgacha. Listen, companies choose to get hashgacha because they feel it helps sell their product.
What's the ethical responsibility of the kosher's agency?
We've had this
charging people for hashgacha because they don't.
I think I've discussed this before. That ethical obligation, I believe, extends to informing the companies that this is totally unnecessary and in no way misleading the public, the observant public, that it is necessary to have hashgacha. And if the company...
They do both, by the way.
They do what?
All the hashgacha agencies do both.
They say that it's not necessary.
No. They actively pursue these companies to give them hashgachas, and because these items have hashgachas, the buying public thinks that they need hashgachas.
Sure. Okay, so our responsibility is to enlighten the world on these matters.
Oh, great.
Yesterday I saw gluten-free water. Luck.
Yeah.
Gluten-free water is like...
Look, I will tell you, I experienced this conflict. I understand this. Look, I don't wish to impugn people's integrity. I think sometimes people see things a certain way and they don't realize it, but I have a student who asked me about Sephardim. Well, there are some Sephardim who still traber, at least in this country, who still take the hindquarters.
Well, they start, yeah.
And they have. They've always had the tradition. Ashkenazim, some have it also, but not here. And his question for me is: he allowed to consume from that meat? So I asked Reshechter, and Reshechter wasn't 100% sure, but he said, you know, he said he didn't. The question was: is there a minhag? He said, if they're reliable, if they know what they're doing. And I said to him, is there a minhag of Ashkenazim not to eat from the hindquarters at all because of that?
It wouldn't be treif. It wouldn't be.
No. The question is: in Ashkenazim, are we allowed to go buy that meat? And so he thought yes, but as he said, there's a tshuva de Achiezer of Reb Chaim Ozer, and the truth is Reb Chaim Ozer was writing during the Nazi era when they basically Jews had no, basically would have lost half the animals. They wouldn't let them sell to non-Jews. If you read the tshuva and many of the tshuvas, it's pretty clear he does not assume that there's a minhag not to traber. It just wasn't worthwhile and it was expensive. And that time he said, you really have to learn how to do it.
We've gone through this. They used to traber in the United States.
I just want to say that I asked Reshechter that question,
right.
And he didn't give an actual answer, but he was note that towards, yeah, there's no minhag. I asked another person, whom I have high regard for, who happens to be involved in the world of kashrus, and he was starting to give me a story, you know, about how, you know, they asked Rav Eliashiv this, about something that, and so on. And, you know, some of it may be just the place that you sit. And as if someone asked me the question, I would say that it's mutter to do so. But it was interesting. It's a person whose integrity I respect, by the way, very much so. But nonetheless, that was the answer, and I was kind of amused. In other words, that's interesting, right? In other words...
So I have a question, because this is actually kind of, I have a friend who's getting involved with this actual thing, and they're looking to set up a slaughterhouse to do tabering and then send that meat to Israel. They're meeting with rabbis in Israel to see if they can
really
accept the meat that's tabered in the United States.
Even though
there'll probably be Israeli taberers coming in to do it, because it's not in the United States.
Whatever. Anyway,
that would be a non-issue. Also.
That should be a non-issue. Also, yes. I don't believe that the minhag really is not to traver. I think
that's besides the point. I'm saying that let's assume that Midgar in the United States is not the favorite.
Right.
Right. And they send someone from Israel throw that away. Only to sell out the Jewish beat back to Israel.
So I don't think the Minhag here, if there was such a Minhag, the Minhag would not be not the Trebier. The Minhag would be is that we here don't eat Trebier meat. Yeah. That's what I think. If there were such a Minhag, I believe that's what the Minhag would be. You can Trebier to your heart's content. The question is, can you eat the meat? So, okay. I look forward to the day where I can consume filet mignon easily purchased in Glad Express and Tina. What's that?
It's the website, Bistro.
I think that's what my student showed me, yes. Is that on the West Coast, I think?
No, it's New Jersey.
Oh, so then it's a different company. So. Are they Sfardim or Ashkenazim? Okay, they are Sfardim also, the place that he showed me. Okay. Anyway, so let's come back to our show. So you cannot buy these things.
If you ate in his house as a private person, if you were invited over to this merchant's home,
yes,
serving you meat.
We'll get there. The Gemara is about to talk about that. So it says that you're not allowed to buy these things. Ela ben amumcha. Okay, you can't buy yayin mor yeschala melas al kondaris chiltis and gavina. Ela ben amumcha. The kulam in the sareach etzel balabayis mutter. But if you're going over to their house and you're their guest and they're serving, you can eat it. Why? Because they'll sell it to others. They just wouldn't eat it for themselves. Pretty deplorable, but nonetheless, that was the reality. And then, that proves Rabbi Shua ben Levi's point. Rabbi Shua ben Levi, shiger lo balabayis lebeso mutter. If one of these balabatim, who was a merchant, if he sends him a gift to his house, so then it's mutter, my taima, balabayis lo shave keter v'ochal isura. First point is that the balabayis, this merchant in Surya, the sender, he himself, since he has the opportunity to get kosher stuff, he's not going to eat treif stuff. And then when he sends the gift to someone else, he sends from his own house. He doesn't send from the store, and therefore that's what Rishu ben Levi said. You can rely upon it. Okay, fine. So now the Gemara says, "Umelach sal kondaris." What is melach sal? My melach sal kondaris. We all want to know. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, melach shekol sal kondari rome ochlanoso. It was some type of a salt. Rashi says that the cooks in Rome all used to use. In other words, apparently it was very, very fancy salt of some kind. Tanura, now what, we still don't know what the problem is with it. So Tanura Banan, Melach Sal Kondara Shchora Asura Levana Muteres, Divi Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that the black salt is Asur, the white salt is Muter. Rabbi Huda Omer Levana Asura Shchora Muteres. The white salt is Asur, the black salt is Muter. Rabbi Huda Ben, we're not done. Rabbi Huda Ben Gamliel, Mishur Ben Gamliel Omer Zevzo Asur. They're both Asur. So now, as it turns out, there's actually no machlokas. Amar Rabba Baruchan Rabbi Yochanan Ledivre Omer Levana Asura. Or I don't say no machlokas. The concern is that Kirvei Dagam Levanim Tameim Uravimba. The concern is that the white fish guts were actually mixed into the salt. And then Ledivre Omer Shchor Asura Kirvei Dagam Shchorim Tameim Uravimba. His assumption was that black fish guts, dark fish guts, were mixed into the salt, and therefore you can't recognize it. That's the key point. And Ledivre Omer Zovazo Asura Zevazem Uravimba. Fine, they were concerned about both. Amar Rabbi Abba, Mishum Rabbi Chanina Megamliel, Zakin Erchot Haya Bishchuna Seinu, Sheyamachlik Poneah Bishumun Chazer. We actually had somebody in our neighborhood, and what he used to do with salt is they used to smear Chazer Schmaltz on it. That was the way the salt was handled. Okay. I assume that reflects a certain reality.
They handle the blocks of salt.
I'm not sure when machlik usually means to smooth the surface. I don't know if it was the purposes of sale or the purposes of flavoring. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but the concern, there was apparently a real concern. Again, I don't think we have melach sal kondaris anymore, unless that's what you're buying, the fancy salts. You didn't read the label carefully. Look in the fine print. It's melach sal kondaris. Aaron doesn't realize there's fish guts mixed into his salt, but he thinks.
What's wrong with iodine again?
What's that?
I said iodine was a problem.
I think, I'm not saying it is a problem. No. That's what they say. The reason why, I'm guessing that's why they require shkacha. The issue of a Pesach, at least, is that the salt typically sold for Pesach doesn't have iodine in it. I don't know what really the source for iodine is. I don't know what really the source of vitamin D is. You know. Okay. All right. Finally, the last line in the Mishnah was, Hare Elu Asurim, Ve'ein Isuram Isur Hana. That was the closing line of the Mishnah. So now the question is, why does the Mishnah have to repeat it? Hare Elu Asurim. We knew that already. Why is that closing line? So the Pshan in the Mishnah might just be, you say the following Asurim Bachila Baramutabana gives you a whole list, and it's sort of just, it's Klalu Pradu Klal. It reminds us the rule at the end. But the Gemara assumes that it must include something else. Hare Elu Asurim. I'm sorry, Hare Elu Asurim is to exclude, as opposed to what? Lima'ute Mai, so Lechiskia, Lima'ute Biyadua. If you remember, going back about a daf and a half, not quite a daf and a half even, the bottom of Lamed Ches Amud Beis, the Mishnah had said that Kvashon Shadarkan Lases L'Tochan Yayin, if you have pickled vegetables where they typically add a little wine in, not automatically, but typically, so that's Asur Bachila, but Mutar, Asur Bishtiya, Asur Bachila, but Mutar Bahana. There was a Machlokes Chiski Rabbi Yochanan, what if you know, what if the Abel Yadua, is it still Asur Bahana, still Mutar Bahana, or once you know they're mixing in wine, then it's Asur Bahana. So, if you hold by Chizkiyah, when the Mishnah says, Hare Elu Asurim, the Eini Surim Asana, that could be to exclude the case of Yadua. Of Kvashim She Yadua, not She Darkon, Kvashim She Yadua She Nos Nimbo Yayin. So then, that would not be included in this Mishnah, that would be included in the first Mishnah. And the Rabbi Yochanan, who says that even Biyadua, Morius is still permitted by Na, so that can't be what the Mishnah is, this last line of the Mishnah is excluding. What is it coming to exclude? Lima'ute Morias Ugvinas Beis Unyaki. It's to exclude Morias and Gvinas Beis Unyaki, which is a special kind of cheese that Rabbi Meir felt was made in the stomachs of calves that were slaughtered for Avodah Zarah. So even though the Chachamim in the beginning of our on Daf Chavtes said that those things are only Asur Bachila, but then Mutar Bana, but Rabbi Meir said that they're also Asur Bana. So Hare Elu, the things in our Mishnah Mutar Bana, but those are not. Ustama Rabbi Meir. Our Stam Mishnah here, this middle Mishnah, is actually Rabbi Meir's opinion. That's why he says, Hare Elu Amutar Bahana. But other things that are not mentioned here, specifically the Gvinas Beis Unyaki and the Morias that was mentioned in the first Mishnah, that is in fact Asur Bahana also. Okay, so that's the end now of round two. And now we get to the last relatively short round, which is the third Mishnah. The first Mishnah was things that are Asur and Asur Bahana. The second Mishnah were things that are Asur but only Ba'achila, only to eat. And now the third Mishnah, which is Ve'elu Mutarim Ba'achila. The following are permitted, even following foods may be eaten. Cholav Shechalavo Oved Kochavim V'Yisrava Ro'ehu. Milk that a non-Jew milked, but the Jew was watching. Now, what's very interesting, what's omitted from this Mishnah, is Gvina. They don't say Gvinas Akum Shegibno Akum V'Yisrael Roa. Cheese that was made by a non-Jew, but a Jew was watching. So the question is that deliberate, or is that just the Mishnah feels no need to state it? So there is actually a Machlokas HaPoskim. It's a Machlokas, the Ramah and the Shach. I think really Medina, we are lenient, although the kashrus organizations try to accommodate the Shach's opinion. The question is it necessary for the Jew to make the cheese? In other words, is it enough that the Jew can observe and can certify that nobody is mixing in anything they shouldn't be mixing? They know that the milk is kosher, they know that the rennet is kosher, and so on. Or is it actually necessary for the Jew to make the cheese? Otherwise, it's called Gvinas Akum. Even though you know there's not kosher in it, it's part of the broad gezeira until the Jew makes it. So the Shach's position is yes, which is, I'm told, I don't know for sure, I'm verified firsthand, but that in many, the kosher cheeses, typically if there's a machinery, the mashkiach presses the button to start the process going. So it's so the Gvina was actually made by a Jew. But I know the Ramah, and I think the Noda de Bihuda, and if I'm not mistaken, Ramosha Feinstein as well, all assume Medina, you actually don't need that. You just need to have make sure you observe that the milk and the rennet and so on was kosher. But be that as it may, what?
Is that a constant, like, do you need a mashgiach to meeting for that, or just a guy coming in every once in a while checking the ingredients?
You mean for the cheese? I think you probably need, like for chalav, you need mirtas, you need yotze v'nichnas, the possibility of him walking at any time. I don't think they require, I don't think there's a mashgiach tamidi for cheese. I don't know. That you have to, meat is the only thing I'm aware of. That, meat, and again, without sealed wine would require the same thing. I don't know, I'm not sure that cheese, chalav certainly doesn't require mashgiach tamidi, it just requires mirtas, right? The Jew's sitting outside, so he could stand up, and the guy could get caught. That's, we'll see in a second. Yeah.
So I don't understand that. Just like what you're saying, Rabbi, the Gvina is the Chumrah circumstance, or the more challenging circumstance. But that's not what the Mishnah says. They're only talking about challah. How do these achronim make the leap that the gvina doesn't require?
So I think the assumption simply is that it's the Mishnah didn't list it for whatever reason, but perhaps it's, in other words, once you say that chalav shel chalav o'achum v'yisrael o'eir sufficient, the same thing is true by gvina. In other words, if gvina is a concern of tarovet, right, the concern of chalav is that the goy mixes in some non-kosher milk, or it is non-kosher milk, but that he may mix some in, right, because otherwise you could just test it. If it curdles, then you know, you take a little bit and test it, make cheese out of it, you know it's kosher, but the concern is he mixes in some non-kosher milk into it. So the cheese is a similar concern. So non-kosher milk, non-kosher rennet for most of the opinions. So if that's the case, if the Yisrael can be omeid v'ro'ehu, as we'll say, if the Yisrael is around, if he's what we call yotze v'nichnas, he can enter at any time, and the guy is afraid to adulterate the product, the same thing should hold true by Gavina as well. The Mishnah shouldn't have to list, as the Gemara sometimes says, Tana ki ruchel aleisha velezel. Does the Tana have to be like a spice peddler? He lists every single thing in his inventory? No, he presents the principle. He says it by milk, and you can expand it even to cheese as well.
I guess the only question is, in cheese, there's another layer, not just the tarovis, right? There's other ingredients.
Other ingredients.
So I think that generally speaking, I never look, but I assume in cheese, for the most part, there are primarily three ingredients. And unless we know that people typically put something in, I mean, I'm not talking about the things where they mix the peppers or the pepper jack, things like that.
Yeah.
But there's salt, there's the milk, and there's rennet. So if cheese is normally made that way, then you don't have to, we're not concerned about going throwing other ingredients just for the heck of it. Right. In other words, when we know that a food is usually made the following way, we don't, outside of the specific halachic concerns that are enumerated, we do not require hashgacha. Meaning, when you're dealing with, if it was assumed that there's factories where they produce, donuts, and you know that nobody uses lard in, again, this may not be true, but let's say you could work the society, nobody uses lard in donuts. Let's say you were in Iran. Yeah, probably true there. I don't recommend visiting necessarily, but let's say you're in Iran and you know that they're not using pork products in there. And assuming that it's, let's say it's paspalter, right? It's a commercially baked bread and they're making donuts, and you know that the only ingredients they put in there are flour, water, sugar, and something like that. And flour doesn't require hashgacha. And if you're not worried about yashan mechadash, water doesn't require hashgacha. Sugar doesn't require hashgacha. So the answer is the donuts don't require hashgacha either. Right, if you know that's what they make in the factory, and there's no reason, we don't assume that somebody goes in at night and just runs some pork through the machines, right? That's just not the way we work. So if the ingredients don't require hashgacha, and there's no reason to assume that the kalim were used otherwise, the food doesn't require hashgacha. Right? The problem that exists, whether it's a real problem or not, can be debated with a lot of commercially produced products, is that there are a lot of other additives. And the question is, what is the status of those additives? But fundamentally speaking, if something is not a specific zera midrabanan, and the ingredients that they use, the norm is to use only kosher ingredients that don't require shkacha, then the product doesn't require shkacha either. Okay, so that's the first one, which is chalav shechalavo ovi kochav misro ehu. Then v'hadvash, honey. Honey doesn't require shkacha. Tomorrow we'll talk about why. V'hadavdanios, which are the grapes. Juicy grapes, afal pi sheminatfin, even though it seems like they're dripping some of their juice already, and you might be concerned about the yayin, because that's what wine is, it's grape juice. Nonetheless, there's no concern about eating it. And the Mishnah says, ein bohem yishum heksha mashke. And this is a very interesting din. This has nothing to do with Avodah Zarah, it has to do with Seder Taros. The halacha is that there are only four categories of things that are susceptible to becoming tameh: adam, kelim, ochlim, and mashkim. So people, vessels, utensils, and food and drink. So the food is the category that's relevant here. Food is makabel tuma if it's edible, but only if it has been mukhshar lekabel tuma. What is hechsher lekabel tuma? It needs to have had a liquid poured over it, put on it, with intent. What is the definition of a liquid? The Mishnah in, there is a Masechta that I'm willing to bet that probably almost no one here has learned. In fact, I could go into my shir and almost no one has learned. I can go to the YBA Spanish. Almost nobody's learned. It's called Maseches Machshirin. It's a little 6-chapter Masechta towards the end of Seder Taros. And Machshirin is mostly about this particular din. The Torah says that when water, v'chiyutan mayim halzerav, and afal miniv lasam alav, tamehu, when the Torah is speaking about foods, zera, if water was placed on that zera, and then nevela, the carcass of a animal that wasn't slaughtered, fell on the food now becomes tameh. But if, however, you have food that did not have water placed on it with intent, after it was detached from the ground, then that food, you could touch a mace to the food, and the food is still tahar. So if you have an apple, and you pick it off the tree, and you haven't washed the apple, and no water has come on that apple since you plucked it off the tree, and now it touches a dead person, the apple is tahar. I know, you might not want to eat the apple, that's a separate question, but that's not our discussion. Okay, it's under the same roof as a mace, okay? That's all about it. What's that?
You wash it afterwards.
Yeah, you probably wash it afterwards, yes. So that's called Hechsher Lekabel Tuma. The Rashbam has a beautiful, it's an interesting metaphor, it doesn't always work, but when it comes to Kalim, a Kli, a utensil, is not Mekabel Tuma until it's completed. Right? So if you're in the middle stages of making it, it's not Mekabel Tuma. Once it's completed, now it's Mekabel Tuma. So he says, I think the Rashbam in his Perish on Chumash says, the same thing is true with the food. It works with some foods. When is an apple ready to eat? After you've washed it off. That's the Gemara for the apple. Typically speaking, the liquid of choice is water. The Mishnah Machshirin says there are actually seven liquids: Yad, Shach, Adam, Yayin, Dvash, Shemen, Chalav, Tal, Dam, and Mayim. Yad, Shach, Adam. So some of those we actually would call water as well. Tal is water, and one of the others I think is water. But bottom line is water is the one that's typically used anyway. It has to be done intentionally. If the cup accidentally spills on the apple, that doesn't count. So that's what the Mishnah is talking about here. That juice that oozed out of the grapes is not machshirit. Ein ba mishum hechsher mashke. It doesn't make the grapes roy lekabel tuma. Why not? Because in order for the mashke to make the grapes roy lekabel tuma, it has to be leratzon. It has to be nichal. It has to be something he wanted. In this case, he doesn't want the juice to ooze out of the grapes. He wants it in the grapes. The Gemara learns this then, interestingly enough. I think there was something similar in Daf Yomi recently. I forget what it was. V'chi yutan mayim al zera. If water is placed on foods, on zera, on things that grow from the ground. So the word yutan is written without a vav. That, grammatically speaking, that's the way it's supposed to be written. But nonetheless, the Chazal say that because yutan is written without a vav, we say yutan, we read it as yitain. V'chi yitain mayim al zera. Not if water was placed on it, but if he placed water on it. Him placing water on it implies intent. And he does that because he wants that. So we say, yutan dumya diyitain. In order for yutan, if it happens on its own, in order for the food to be susceptible to be mekabel tuma, it has to be that you're happy with the result. If you see it and you're happy with it, even though you didn't do it, now the food is moshe lekabel tuma. But if you're not pleased with the result, you didn't want the liquid on there, then the food is not mekabel tuma. So the Mishnah here says that the grapes, even though they are menatfim, they're not moshe lekabel tuma. Fine. Ukvashim she'ein darak alaseis l'sochan yayin, pickled vegetables that you typically don't put, they don't typically put wine into. V'tarish she'ein otrufa. Taris was like the sardines or whatever, the fish. If it's not chopped up, so you can see the individual fish, and you can see that they're kosher. V'tzir she'yesh badaga. If you have fish brine that has this daga, this special fish, the daga kilbis, swimming in it, so that's a sign that everything is kosher. The brine is kosher because otherwise that fish wouldn't be in there. The olah shel chiltis, not the koret shel chiltis, not the little carrots of it, not the little pieces of the stinky smelling asafoetida, but rather the leaves of the vegetable. If you olah shel chiltis is not a problem because that's not sharp, and we're not concerned about the knife. That the leaf will turn the stuff on the knife into something that's flavorable, that's good flavor. Zeise gluskaos Rashi says, are olives that were put in this vessel. The purpose of the vessel was to keep them close together and to cause them to get warm, to cause them to ripen very quickly. And the concern might be that one of the things, you would have thought, that one of the things the non-Jews will do is they'll add a little, alcohol, a little wine into it to help the process along. So the answer is no. Rabbi Yose Omer, Hashlachen Asurim. The Gemara will explain what this means, but he's talking about certain olives. Rabbi Yose thinks actually are osir because he thinks that because something happened, it's an indicator they may have used wine. Gemara will talk about it. Then, ha-chagavim ha-ba'im min ha-slula asurin min ha-heftek mutarim. If the non-Jew is selling grasshoppers, and these grasshoppers, you can identify them that they're kosher, but the concern is that he might have put a little wine in to add flavor, to add some smell. So it depends where you're buying the grasshoppers from. If it's in the small jar in the store that he has out for everybody to come take from, then it's usher, because that stuff sells relatively quickly. Now, as he goes through the jar, and therefore he's not afraid to put wine in, because the wine may cause also the grasshoppers to spoil more quickly, the liquid and so on. So there we're concerned he put it in. But if he's going back to the storehouse to take out a fresh barrel, there you don't have to worry about having put him wine in, because that takes much longer to sell. He's not going to put it in there because the fear might be maybe business slows down a little bit and the grasshoppers spoil much more quickly. Okay. And finally, the Mishnah says, V'chein l'truma, and the Gemara will explain what that line means. Okay. Let's at least tackle the Chal of Yisrael issue. Maybe next week, not next week, I think there's no shear next. I know there's no shear next week, but I think on the schedule, so there's no shear. But God willing, in 2 weeks, maybe I will bring in Ramosha's tshuva about Chal of Yisrael in America. So I think it's worth seeing. So let's at least just for now, let's take on the Gemara's piece here, which serves as the basis for Ramosha's discussion. The previous Mishnah had said that Chalav Shechalavo, Chalav Shechalavo, Ovdei Kochavim, the Ein Yisrael Ro'ehu, is Asur to eat. Our Mishnah says that Chalav Shechalavo Eino Ehudi V'Yisrael Ro'ehu, but the Jews watching him, so then it's permissible to eat that Chalav. So the Gemara says, Tanina Laha Detana Rabbanan. Our Mishnah has taught the same lesson that the following Braisa teaches. Yoshev Yisrael B'tzad Edro Shel Ovdei Kochavim, the Ovdei Kochavim Cholev Lo. A Jew may sit next to the flock of a non-Jew, and the non-Jew can milk the animals and bring the Jew milk, and the Jew does not have to be worried that it's non-kosher milk. So the Gemara says, "Hey Chidami, what's the case?" It sounds like you don't see him doing milking. It's idaleka davar tamei beedro. If there are no non-kosher animals in the non-Jew's flock, pshita. Why would you think it's a problem? If, in fact, there are some non-kosher animals in the flock that he could have milked, so then the question is, Am I? Why are you allowed to? How do you know that he didn't take the non-kosher milk? So the Gemara says, La'olam di'ika davar tameh. There is a davar tameh. You want to know why is the milk kosher? V'chi ka'i chazilei. If he's ka'i, means ka'im, if he stands up, he can see the non-Jew. However, when he's sitting down, he's sitting outside the corral. He's sitting in a chair. He doesn't like to stand. So when he's sitting down, he can't see the non-Jew. Mahu the tema kevin the yosef lo chazilei. Nechush duma maisim arebe. You might have thought that since when the Jew is sitting down, he can't see the non-Jew doing it, that the non-Jew might take that opportunity to bring some non-kosher milk and mix it in. Kamash Malan, the Gemara says, no. The Bryce is telling us that that's not so. Chevan de chicha chazile. Since if the Jew, came in the chai, chazile, if the Jew were to stand up, he would see him, irtuse mirtas. The guy literally means trembling, he's afraid, veloma arifa, and therefore he doesn't mix anything in. So this, we will see, God willing, in a couple of weeks. This is what Ramosha invokes, this idea of mirtas, that whenever there's a situation that the guy is fearful of mixing and of adulterating the product, then that's the equivalent of a Jew sitting right outside the corral, where v'chi ka'i chazile. If you stand up, you can see it.
Whose bucket is the guy using?
The Rishonim talk about that. The assumption is either the Jew gave him the pail, he saw the pail was empty or something like that. Yeah. Let's assume you either there's one pail and either you give it to him or you see the pail and it's empty. But yes, they talk about that issue. How do you know there isn't milk in the pail, treif milk in the pail to start
with? Even if there's nothing, isn't it spolei or not?
It's cold and it's not going to stay there long. We don't, l'chatchila, generally, you're not supposed to...
Hot milk comes out warm.
That?
Comes out warm out of the animal.
It's funny you say it. The Gemara in the first parak in Chulin talks about shechting with a knife with tarfus on it, the concern that the beis hashchita is warm, is hot, and therefore maybe you have to be kolef. Maybe it's bolea kedei klipa. So it's not... The notion of organic substances containing heat is not one that's foreign either. If you look in the... I call this is the second. This is the first law of rabbinic thermodynamics, which doesn't correspond to contemporary physics. The Mishnayos in the fourth parak in Shabbos talk about hatmana, insulating stuff on Shabbos. So the halacha is that you're not allowed to insulate something bedavar hamosif hevel, and something that actually adds heat. The Mishnah then lists a number of things that add heat, and the problem is it's impossible. Without a fire source, no matter what blankets you wrap something in and how well it preserves the heat, it can't actually be mosif hevel. It happens to be there are a few substances that are listed there that actually, and the Gemara sometimes distinguishes some things are mosif hevel only if they're wet. And some of the things they mention are gefes. Gefes is the psoles shel zeisim. When you, after you press the olives and you have the oil, the leftover stuff, right? So if it's still moist, the Gemara describes that mosif hevel, which is actually not crazy. Because if you think about compost, you go to a compost heap in the winter, the inside of a compost heap you can burn yourself on. So organic materials decomposing actually can get rather hot. Now, the beis hashchita is not hot enough to, it's not yatzo ledes and so on, and the milk is not coming out of the cow, it's not yatzo ledes. It may be warmer than room temperature, but that should not be, ordinarily, that's not enough, you know, to be considered certainly to have serious blia. So where it's said in the Gemara, like the chom beis hashchita, of the place where they shech, that there's a certain degree of warmth, a little bit, so we might be machmir there, but I don't think we're concerned about the milk coming into the pail with the cows anyway. Besides which, that would bring us to the second law of rabbinic thermodynamics, which I am currently teaching, which is what's known as tata gavar. There's a machlokas rav and shmuel. If you have a hot substance that falls onto a cold substance, which is the one that dominates thermodynamically to determine whether you're dealing with a mixture of hot or mixture of cold? So if you have boiling milk that falls onto cold meat, or cold milk that falls onto boiling meat, do you say ilah gavar, the upper one dominates, or tata gavar? We pass in tata gavar, I think.
So you're
the bottom substance, that's a complicated discussion. I at least like to say this has a remote hint in real thermodynamics that the bottom one is the one that dominates, that's because heat rises. So anyway, that's the second law of rabbinic thermodynamics. But we assume that the milk coming out of the cow, when the pail is cold, we say tata gavar, I don't think that we have to worry about that. But the Rishonim do talk about the question of how do you know that the pail was empty to start with. But once you know the pail is empty to start with, and the Jew can stand up and see the non-Jews, so once you have this chazaka of mirtas, so the Gemara says there is no problem with the milk.